It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, political divides in Wisconsin leave a lot of people feeling discouraged about civic participation. A UW-Madison researcher joins us with a new report on what's driving us apart and how we can strengthen democracy in the state. First, pick a number, 1 to 100. Got it? Chances are good there's a healthy, maybe even heated sports debate around who owns that particular number. Owns, like, for example, the number 12. Lots of players have worn it. Lots of big-name football quarterbacks. It's one way to choose who you're comparing. Which one was best while wearing it? Who gets to be at the top of the 12s? Debates like these rise and fall in stadium seats, dinner tables, bars, and social media threads. And our next guest was part of a team that settled 100 of those debates forever, or at least for a couple minutes. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Is there a number? When you think of that, you think of that particular player in sports at whatever level, global, across the country, or here in Wisconsin. Is this a question you've ever debated with friends or family members? Is there a current Wisconsin player who might own a particular number in the future? And why is it Giannis Antetokounmpo? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Paul Hemikitis, also known as Hembo, is a content producer for ESPN's Get Up. He partners with Mike Greenberg on ESPN Radio's Greeny. They're co-authors of the new book, Got Your Number, The Greatest Sports Legends and the Numbers They Own. Hembo, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, the pleasure's all mine. This has been as much fun to talk about as we could have possibly imagined. When you write a book, you obviously put it on ice for quite some time. And over the last couple of weeks, as we've been doing things like these, it's just been such a delight to see the amount of interest and opinion that this idea has generated. So it is a delight to talk with you today. And I'm hoping that you and I will find some common ground with these numbers and maybe even some disagreements along the way, too. That's part of the fun.
It definitely. And that's one of my takeaways from this book is, of course, these are highly subjective and highly personal things. But the choices you've made are great conversation starters. Was that part of the goal from the outset?
Yes, that is most definitely part of the goal. So I would describe the book as having sort of two pillars, if you will. The first is what you just described, sports debate. Numbers are obviously the vernacular of every sports fan. Whether you are a casual fan, whether you are a passionate fan, you are at least to some degree fluent in numbers. And that has been something that has become exceedingly clear as we have kind of unveiled this idea and talked to fans and readers across the country. But the second half of it is sports history. And that is really what I major in as someone who sort of made his bones at ESPN first and foremost as a researcher. That's really what I took a lot of pride in when it comes to this project. Obviously, a lot of these decisions were excruciating. But once we made them, it was my responsibility to drum up the very, very best numbers that money could buy to justify each and every one of our selections. So like I said, you might disagree, and justifiably so, on some of the decisions that we made. But my hope and my expectation is that when you do get a chance to read our book, Got Your Number, at minimum, we can make a defensible case why we chose each of the people in most cases that we chose. And that's the very best that we can do.
And the criteria, you know, you might be comparing a NFL quarterback against a Major League Baseball shortstop. Obviously, you can't take numbers and compare them. Can you talk about some of the things that went into this? Some of it's the statistics. Some of it's the significance. And as you mentioned, the place in sports history.
Yes. Yeah, so much of it is the legend of the player. So I'll just throw out a number, for example, and show you some of the excruciating decisions that we struggle through. So especially comparing players across sports, how do you do it? So for example, number 21, worn by Roberto Clemente, worn by Tim Duncan, worn by Deion Sanders, worn by LaDainian Tomlinson. I mean, truly, it's a fool's errand to try and scientifically, objectively, discern who is the person that owns that number, right? So what you have to then do is use other criterion. I think in this case, the way that I would describe these players, just again, as an example, Roberto Clemente is probably the greatest legend that ever wore number 21. Tim Duncan is probably the most accomplished. Deion Sanders is, I think, beyond most question, the greatest player at his position ever. And by that measure, probably the cornerback by whom all other corners that have since come have been compared and probably will until the end of time. So you're forced to make excruciating decisions based upon as much science as you can. But ultimately, there's as much an art to this as there is a science. And in some cases, the longer, like the older a player you were, the longer your legend has endured while not being a tiebreaker for us in many cases. So we really canvass more than a century of sports history in so doing.
Talking to Paul Hembakidis, talking about a new book he co-wrote. It's called Got Your Number, The Greatest Sports Legends and the Numbers They Own. You could join in at 800-642-1234. I know this is public radio, and sometimes you're a little shy about admitting that you're a sports fan. I know you're out there. Call in with your favorite sports player, the most important, the one you say, yeah, they own that number on their jersey. They're the greatest in that jersey of all time. Call in with your questions for our guest about how they made these choices, who got chosen, and were you lucky enough to see some of the legends who at least might be in the running play? Maybe Hank Aaron. We'll start naming names in a minute. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, other great Wisconsin legends. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Paul, I want to start naming names, and I want to start with the greatest player to ever play for the Eau Claire Bears, plus the Milwaukee Brewers and Atlanta Braves, Hank Aaron, number 44. And I think there's a really solid case that he should own number 44. Talk about that.
I think we could be playing sports for another 1,000 years, and Henry Aaron would still be the person that you would say owns the number 44. It is still, candidly, a crowded field. Willie McCovey and Reggie Jackson both wore number 44 from the game of baseball. Jerry West wore number 44 in his NBA career and his college career. Pete Maravich wore the number 44. Jim Brown wore the number 44 in college. I created lists like this for literally every single number, 1 through 100, you might imagine, because it was important to me, important to us, to canvas the world of sports, to not assume that we could possibly forget or miss anybody. But in the case of Henry Aaron, I mean, obviously, there are two numbers for which you strongly associate him. It's 44 and it's 755. I guess, you know, he had to get to 715 before he got to 755. That would have been a much longer book. So in the absence of being able to go past the number 100, it was clear to me that 44 was where he belonged. You can make a very credible argument that Henry Aaron is, if not the most accomplished hitter that ever lived, perhaps the most productive hitter that ever lived. It is very likely that you talk to sports fans 100 years from now, and they will still consider him, and not Barry Bonds, the all-time record holder. I think 755 is a much more enduring number than 762 because of that. Parenthetically, the number of total bases that Henry Aaron accumulated throughout his career, there is a chasm between he and Albert Pujols, who ranks second on that list. I'm talking about seasons that Albert Pujols would still need to play at a high level in order to catch him. I mean, truthfully, Henry Aaron is in the very last sentence of greatest baseball player that ever lived. You could not possibly write a book like this without including Henry Aaron. When we were going through our list, 1 through 100, that was one of those numbers. Even though there's some other great athletes to wear 44, that we moved lickety-split. It was Henry Aaron. His name was mentioned, and we moved on to number 45. That's how convinced we were that Henry Aaron owned the number 44.
You share some of the history in the book, too, and I knew about the death threats that came to him as he was pursuing Babe Ruth's championship. As a black player, people weren't happy about this. One anecdote you share is about what looked like a hug from Hank Aaron's mom after he broke that record. The true story behind that?
Yes. She later admitted, I guess somewhat begrudgingly, that she was doing that in part to shield her son from the snipers. I mean, we are living at a time in which Henry Aaron is now considered baseball royalty. But the fact of the matter is, Henry Aaron encountered enormous obstacle and prejudice along the way. I mean, Bowie Kuhn, the commissioner of Major League Baseball, was not even in attendance. Henry Aaron's belief many years later was that Braves fans were somewhat reluctant to credit him with passing Babe Ruth. And fans around the country, in some cases, were fighting against him. He famously kept a lot of that hate mail. And amidst that torrent of hatred and bigotry, he stood above it all. He rose above it all. My favorite quote, I think, that Henry Aaron ever said in relation to that home run chase, despite all of that, is, "I don't want them to forget Babe Ruth. I just want them to remember me." Think about that and the kind of person you have to be for that to be your high-level takeaway after enduring all that he did.
Talking to Paul Hembakidis, content producer for ESPN's Get Up, co-author of the new book, Got Your Number, The Greatest Sports Legends and the Numbers They Own. You can join in with your opinions, your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Is there a Wisconsin athlete who's on your greatest of all time list? We'll see if they're in contention to make it in this book of numbers. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Hembo Hembakidis with ESPN's Get Up and Greeny programs. He's co-author of the new book, Got Your Number, The Greatest Sports Legends and the Numbers They Own. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Who to you is the biggest legend in your sport of choice? The greatest achievement in sports history in Wisconsin and beyond? You can join in at 800-642-1234. If there's a number you associate with a star athlete, tell us about it. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Let's bring on a caller. Patrick is with us in Wausau. Patrick, hi.
Good afternoon.
What'd you want to bring up, Patrick?
I'd like to know who owns number 15. I think it should be Bart Starr.
It's a strong case, Patrick, to be made for Bart Starr. I think I got bad news for you, Hembo, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, we determined that Bart Starr does not own the number 15, though there is no question that a great case could be made and should be made in some cases for Bart Starr. Number 15 is challenging. So in the current game today, you have Patrick Mahomes, who I think one could reasonably argue is already on a Hall of Fame track, and is a player for whom 10 or 15 years from now, we might consider him one of the very greatest of all time. Obviously, Bart Starr's legend and career is etched in stone, playing quarterback for the Green Bay Packers, and is a legendary figure in the sports history. What we also wanted to do, however, in creating this book was sort of make a composite of all sports, and which in that case, that includes things that are beyond just jersey numbers. It includes jersey numbers that are beyond just the four major sports. So as you might expect, you will find plenty of professional football and basketball and baseball and hockey players. What you should also know is that only 56 out of the 100 chapters are assigned jersey numbers, which is to say you'll find cases in which we've assigned a number to a record or to a year. So in other words, this has a little bit more diversity than maybe I've led on to believe. However, zooming out, what I would like to say is that it is our belief that Tim Tebow might well be the greatest college quarterback that ever lived. There are not many college football players in our book, but it is our belief that Tim Tebow and his legend at the University of Florida and winning multiple championships and winning the Heisman as an underclassman and then becoming a finalist on other occasions had a career in college, the gravity of which exceeded that of Bart Starr's in the NFL. Now, I'm on Wisconsin public radio right now. And so there is a really, really good chance that if you are within the sound of my voice, you strongly disagree with that. And you are allowed to disagree with that. However, it was our belief that Tim Tebow owns the number 15 based upon his legendary college career. And while Bart Starr makes an excellent case, and while Bart Starr was absolutely among our finalists and potentially even a runner-up, what we could not possibly do was make everyone happy. That's part of the fun. There are only 100 chapters, and so ultimately, as unsatisfying as it is to say on Wisconsin public radio, Tim Tebow for us owns the number 15.
Patrick, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Another one of those numbers I wanted to bring up that isn't a jersey number, Babe Didrikson at number 46, Olympic track and field athlete, golfer, like just all athletics all the time. Inspirational to a number of girls growing up in athletics, including a daughter of mine, an athlete who wrote one of her big school reports on Babe Didrikson. Can you talk about her and her ownership of the number 46?
Absolutely. So again, I want to double back on one of the attributes of this book that I'm so proud of, and that is the inclusion of sports from a wide range, the inclusion of female athletes for which you could not credibly do this book without. And it is my belief that Babe Didrikson might well be the greatest female athlete of all time, at least in the history of our country. If you're not familiar with her backstory, it's a fascinating one. But she ranked 10th. She ranked number 10 in Sports Century's retrospective, I guess now 23 years ago. And so even if you were to take into account some of the female athletes that have since come to pass, she is at the very, very top of that list. We assigned Babe Didrikson number 46. So she was an incredible Olympian. 1932 was her greatest year as an Olympian, but 1946 was her greatest year as a golfer. She was a legendary golfer, and it was exceedingly important for us to include her in addition to a number of other female athletes. And so ultimately, based upon her extraordinary resume and reputation, both as an Olympian, as a star in that world, and also then later in the world of golf, I mean, dominating multiple sports for a long period of time, she was a shoe-in for the book. The challenge was to find a good number for her because, of course, she did not compete in a team sport, at least not directly. And thus, we assigned 46 to her based upon her exploits in the year of 1946.
Talking to Hembo Hemakidis, the new book is Got Your Number, The Greatest Sports Legends and the Numbers They Own. You can join in if there's a number you attach to a particular athlete, a jersey number or achievement number at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Paul, a very personal one for me. I grew up in the Detroit radio market. And the legend is I was named Rob after the guy from the Dick Van Dyke Show. Choice number two was Gordy. After Gordie Howe, Detroit Red Wings legend, was this an easy choice for you at number nine?
Yes, I think his body of work is I think almost incomparable when you consider how beloved Gordie Howe is both in that city and in the game of in the sport of hockey, but also the longevity with which he played. I mean, there are numbers that are in this book that I could not believe, and I'm someone who majors in this stuff every single day. That being said, while we did land on Gordie Howe at number nine, Greeny and I did a book signing yesterday for which someone had a very credible question and asked, how did you justify Gordie Howe over Ted Williams, the splendid splinter, a person who walks down the street and you say, there goes the greatest hitter that ever lived. First of all, no one in the world, I don't know a single person who's a bigger baseball fan than I am. Baseball is well represented in our book, and that I can assure you. But even so, it is my belief that Gordie Howe's legend and stature within his sport, frankly, is greater than Ted Williams and his stature within his. That was one for which it was obviously excruciating to choose. But in the end, Greeny and I did come to consensus. It is Gordie Howe and not Ted Williams that owns the number nine.
Back to our callers. Mitch is with us in West Allis. Mitch, hi.
Hi. I would like to nominate Dale Earnhardt, the Intimidator, for number three.
Mitch, thanks a lot for the call. Now, NASCAR is represented. You had Richard Petty, I think, and Jimmy Johnson, very justifiably. Dale Earnhardt, I didn't think intimidated his way into number three, though.
No, and that is because if this book had one chapter, it would be Babe Ruth at number three. I mean, who are we kidding? If you were to do a book here, a sports book, for which you were assigning who owns every number 1 through 100, you could not, in my judgment, you could not make a credible case that anyone could be number three except for Babe Ruth. It just cannot be done. Babe Ruth, I think, is on the very short list, along with Muhammad Ali and Tiger Woods and Michael Jordan, as the greatest athletes that our nation has ever produced. His cultural significance was enormous. His significance on the game of baseball and it becoming something recognizable like what it is now. Like without Babe Ruth, baseball might well have looked very different for the last 100 years. Babe Ruth retired, and the records that he set, especially in the power department, some of which have not been touched, and most of which were not touched for decades. Babe Ruth essentially rewrote baseball's record book and holds an enormous place in the American sporting landscape. There are two drivers in the book. Richard Petty owns number 43. Spoiler alert. Jimmy Johnson owns the number 48. Spoiler alert. But ultimately, this is about the numbers. And in my judgment, you cannot make a credible case for Dale Earnhardt over the Bambino.
Mitch, thanks a lot for that call. I want to look toward the future. Here in Wisconsin, we got Giannis Antetokounmpo. In the future, he might own number 34. I know, he's still playing. He's got a while to go. To get it, he has to beat out Walter Payton. What do you think about that debate of the future, Hembo?
So this was a challenge for us. One thing our book is fairly light on is current active athletes, and that's because, well, so much of these things are decided through the anthology of history, right? And so I think there is a very credible case to be made that by the time Giannis retires, he will be the number 34 in all of sports. But right now, that is a list that includes Walter Payton and Charles Barkley and Hakeem Olajuwon and David Ortiz. Might Giannis someday occupy that top spot? Absolutely. But the bottom line of it is he chose a number that is absolutely stacked and loaded, and he's still only 28 years old. One thing for which we were not comfortable doing, hence our Patrick Mahomes decision, was projecting. We were not comfortable making assumptions about what a player might become. That sort of defeats the purpose of the exercise. The ownership of a number is something that does take time to develop and then crystallize. And in this case, with Walter Payton running his entire career in Chicago wearing the number 34, as you guys all unfortunately know, it was very difficult for us to make a case for Giannis or frankly anyone else aside from Sweetness.
I want to go to number one now. It was Ozzie Smith, legendary shortstop. You know, there's these rule changes in baseball now. I hear the name Ozzie Smith, the This Week in Baseball theme song from the 80s pops into my head when they had the montage of amazing defensive plays. That one, I love that choice because it's like a game of a different time that maybe with these new rules is going to come back or we're going to see players making plays like that again with the ball and play more.
Baseball is now going to return to a time in which being athletic mattered way more than it did even 1 year ago. Baseball is going to now reward players with a wide variance of skill set. Baseball is no longer going to be a sport for which a game will be decided via home run derby. Now, I don't think baseball is going to be, say, totally unrecognizable. Although I suppose if you drop someone in today and you begun watching with a pitch clock, you might say to yourself, well, this is pretty unrecognizable. But a player like Ozzie Smith last year would not have been so valuable. This year would likely be eminently valuable because the ease with which you can steal bases now and the abolition of the shift has put a premium on middle infield defense. Well, who could do those things better than Ozzie Smith? He is inarguably the greatest infielder of all time. And by the way, he stole 580 bases. In our opinion, Ozzie Smith is a great way to kick off the book. He is on the very short list of the greatest shortstops of all time, obviously. And the Wizard of Oz and players like that didn't really have a place in baseball over the last 15, 20, 25 years. In all candor, my earnest hope, as someone who very much, as you can tell, enjoys the history of baseball, is that those kinds of players enjoy a renaissance with the rule changes.
Well, we can agree on that. And Hembo, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, bud.
That's Paul Hembo Hembakidis, content producer for ESPN, partner of Mike Greenberg on ESPN Radio's Greeny. We talked to him about a new book he's co-authored with Greenberg called Got Your Number, The Greatest Sports Legends and the Numbers They Own. Coming up after the news, we'll hear the results of the new Civic, Fracture, and Renewal survey from UW-Madison that aims to identify our biggest political divides and some ideas on how to repair them. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, this year's college women's basketball tournament wrapped up yesterday and set records for TV viewership, at points even surpassing the audience for the NBA's ESPN broadcast. We'll talk to a sports writer about what has people excited about the sport and where it goes from here. Now, a lot of Wisconsinites report feeling politically divided and civically disengaged. The Center for Communication and Civic Renewal at UW-Madison conducted a recent survey of Wisconsin residents. It focused on where those fractures are happening and how we might be able to build a healthier political climate. The idea is to strengthen democracy in the state and build upon shared values of civic health, even when we disagree politically. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Where do you see these political divides, these civic fractures in your life? Have you stopped talking about politics with friends and family? Or stop talking to friends and family because of politics? Have you been able to bridge a political divide with someone you disagree with? Do you feel able to participate in politics by voting, volunteering, getting involved in your community? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Mike Wagner is a journalism professor and faculty director of the Center for Communication and Civic Renewal at UW-Madison. Mike, welcome back to Central Time.
Great to be here, Rob.
Before we dig into the finer points of what you've learned from Wisconsinites, remind us the mission, the goal, what you're trying to find out here.
We really want to understand how Wisconsinites are experiencing democracy and how the way that they kind of engage in their overall information ecology, where they get their news, who they talk to, whether they're posting about politics and social media or not, how all those things kind of mix together to help us understand where we can find places to agree and how we can disagree in healthier ways than some of us might be.
Let's start with the parts that you found worrisome. And you, in the report, you'd characterize some things as disturbing. What stood out to you as the worst news you encountered?
I would say there were a couple of things, one of which was that 60% of Wisconsinites have stopped talking about politics with someone with whom they disagree. And I think that's bad for a couple of reasons, because you might stop talking politics because you don't want to engage anymore. Maybe you feel like you can't defend your argument, and so you walk away, or maybe you find it annoying, or maybe you find it anxiety-producing to have to debate politics. But it also could be that you stop talking politics with somebody because somebody said things that made you feel like who you are doesn't count, or that you don't have a place in the state, or that it's okay for you to feel like you're in danger. So there's good reasons and bad reasons to stop talking politics, but almost 2 out of 3 of us have done it, and that's kind of worrisome. And I would say another one is that when it comes to – this is just people who are strongly approving of President Trump – but 60% of folks who are strong approvers of President Trump said that they agreed with the statement that the traditional way of American life is disappearing so fast that we may have to use force to save it. And so now saying you agree with that statement is several steps removed from engaging in actual political violence. So let's make sure that you know, caveat is there. But the fact that, you know, people are willing to say, yeah, I like the idea of using force to get what I want in this country if I'm not getting it at the ballot box is something that we should, I think, take seriously.
Well, both of those in a way point toward a concern that, okay, a political difference isn't just a minor disagreement over policy, but potentially an existential threat. If I'm not talking to someone because of a fundamental decision, I might think that they want to end democracy as it exists, as I perceive it, and the thought of violence might be in the same category.
I think that's right, and I think part of it stems from the misperceptions we have about what it is the other side thinks, and how it is the other side gets there, how we think the other side gets their information. And so we tend to think the other side is more extreme than it actually is, and we tend to think that they live in a filter bubble of information that is an echo chamber that just tells them that they're right and that the other side is evil, whereas we, the ideal citizen, you know, get our information from a wide variety of sources and challenge our point of view. And we tend to overestimate our own willingness to engage in sort of, you know, positive information seeking and challenging our point of view. And we tend to underestimate how much other people do that. And with that perception leads to some of these things that you're talking about, I think.
And I don't want to have people come away right at the outset thinking this is all bad. There's all scary stuff here. You see signs of hope, signs of ways, at least paths to rebuilding our connections.
Oh, yeah. So even though there are sharp signs of civic fracture and barriers to political participation in our state, there are lots of signs that we have paths forward that there's broad agreement on. And one of those is just when we ask people, is it better for our leaders to stick to their principles no matter what, even if nothing gets done, or compromise, even if they, you know, have to, you know, not get everything they want or compromise away something that they might prefer? 3-1, by a margin of 3-1, Wisconsinites say, let's compromise. Like, principles are important, but let's make some kind of progress. And that is a bipartisan feeling. Republicans and Democrats feel that in relatively equal measure. And there's a strong hunger for that. There's also 80% of us trust that our votes were counted in elections. And so that's a good number, right? We'd like it to be even higher. But in a state like Wisconsin, where turnout is almost always in the top three in the country, you know, 4 out of 5 of us think I'm very confident my vote was getting counted. That's good as well. Wisconsinites are also strongly in favor of nonpartisan redistricting, which is a fair way to apportion the way that our lawmakers end up getting to represent us. And so there's lots of paths that transcend party boundaries in our state, despite the contentious political climate that we have, especially the day before a major election in our state.
I wanted to ask about the redistricting result. As it happens, Republicans have controlled the redistricting process to their benefit. It happens the other way in other states sometimes.
Right.
But you might think, okay, well, of course, Republicans will love this. Democrats will hate it in Wisconsin. There was a difference, but still a majority of Republicans supported a different way of drawing these maps.
That's right. And that was true even for Republicans who were made aware that, hey, the current system advantages Republicans. And so it wasn't the case that that Republicans in Wisconsin were saying, hey, we should hold on to our advantage here. They were saying, hey, we should probably engage in a process that's a little bit more fair. We may not always have the advantage, and when we don't, it would be better to have a fairer process. And a nonpartisan commission where one side doesn't get to dictate to the other what happens has been something that's been pretty successful in other states, and is something that a majority of Wisconsinites and a majority of Republicans would support. And, you know, it's also the case that if we engaged in a different kind of districting process in Wisconsin, it would certainly be likely to help Democrats, but it probably would not be enough to change the majority of the state legislature. So Republicans wouldn't be giving away, in all likelihood, their majority in the state Senate or state assembly, but it wouldn't be as large as it is today.
Talking to Mike Wagner with the Center for Communication and Civic Renewal at UW-Madison, looking at their work, recent work, and over the years, looking at political and civic divides and ways to bridge them here in the state. And you could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or questions or maybe experiences. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Willem is with us in Colfax. Hi, Willem.
Hi. You know, the civil society is very important to, you know, everyone's well-being. That's, you know, we look through at history and we see where these kind of divisions lead. But everyone, whether you're a supporter of the former president or not, everyone flushes their toilet and expects it to be treated and clean water to come out of their taps and police and fire and all that. And that's what makes the civil society. So we can't, you know, let these divisions put that at risk.
Willem, thanks a lot for the call. It's an interesting point, Mike, that I think about sometimes. A lot of our society operates on huge amounts of trust that things will work in particular ways that are invisible, where we don't see the ways we're interconnected, as Willem points out.
Right, and I think Willem makes a great point that, you know, just imagine how it would completely dominate our political discourse if suddenly toilets across Wisconsin stopped working. We would be talking about, you know, sewer regulation and water treatment and all of these kinds of things that aren't headline-making issues under most circumstances, right? And it's because, I think as Willem points out, there's lots of things that government does and that politics does that happen behind the scenes in kind of a what some scholars call the submerged state. Like, you don't see it if roads are working well and if you have good Wi-Fi in your community and those kinds of things. And so a lot of that is essential to conducting business, to getting kids to school, to having a chance to do things that are fun in your community. And to the extent that we start fraying our politics to the point where we might not even trust folks to do the basics, that's where we start. That's one area where we might say we should really start to feel worried about the state of our political culture. And there are increasing examples of people saying they just don't trust people on the other side to do things. And if it comes to the point where we wouldn't, you know, we're asking a plumber their party affiliation, you know, I think that, you know, that would be a sign that we're in some deep doo-doo.
Well, thanks for the call. Robin joins us now in Wausau. Robin, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to bring up, Robin?
I have a kind of a personal situation in my neighborhood right now. One of my neighbors over the weekend put up an American flag upside down, and I'm ex-military, and when I was in the Coast Guard, one of my I was responsible for the care and protocol of using the American flag, and I find this very distressful, and I happen to look it up, and I see that there's a federal statute stating that you should only do such a thing if you're under what is the term, dire distress.
Distress, yes.
And I don't quite know what to do. I really want to say something to him. He's been a great neighbor. I mean, he comes over and he's a snowblow for me, and
Robin, I interesting case. Now, I've seen, Mike, again, the official code is this is dire distress. I've seen people on the left and on the right do the upside down American flag thing as a sign, like expressing political distress. You're not a personal advice columnist, Mike,
right,
but you have thoughts on how we can have a discussion in a place where clearly we disagree, but we see some positive things about the other person, too.
Well, I first of all, I think it's really a really good start that the caller's orientation is, you know, this thing makes me uncomfortable. There are things I've done in my life in service to my country that are a part of why this makes me feel uncomfortable. And I believe that my neighbor's a good person and has done nice things for me. And so, like, that is so much further down the field of what it is that we need to help civil society than saying, I'm going to make some assumptions about whoever put the flag up in that way, and I'm just going to decide that I don't like them. Right? And so being willing to engage in an open conversation and just say, you know, hey, you know, we've gotten along for a long time and been good neighbors, and I just want you to know that this thing makes me uncomfortable. And you know, that...
Well, and
that,
here's his story, too, I think.
Yeah, yeah, and here's my story, and here's why. And that might open a place where, you know, the neighbor might feel, again, like as you say, not advice columnist. I'm just kind of, you know, riffing here. But you could imagine, like research about having uncomfortable conversations. You know, basically, the conclusion is basically aim for the heart and not the head, right? Mm-hmm. So instead of saying, I'm right, there's a statute that says you can't do this, right? Instead, it's, this makes me uncomfortable and here's why. Why don't you tell me why you're doing it, right? Because part of what makes civil society healthy is our willingness to listen, which is different than waiting for our turn to talk, right? And so being open to, you know, if someone's doing that kind of political act, there's probably a reason or set of reasons they're doing that. And so to be open to listening to that and starting a dialogue, even if, you know, the ultimate conclusion is, well, I disagree, is healthier than developing a set of, you know, unknown assumptions about people and then, you know, treating them differently because of it. And so I think the caller is doing the right thing, which is to think about, here's what I don't like about what's happening, and here are positive things I know about this person, which makes me not want to write them off immediately.
Robin, thanks a lot for sharing that experience. Good luck in dealing with it. We're talking to UW-Madison journalism professor Mike Wagner about Wisconsin's political divides and ways we can repair civic engagement here in the state. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you concerned about political divides in Wisconsin and beyond? Have you stopped talking to someone, period, or stopped talking to someone about politics because of differing political views? Or have you found ways to keep those contacts alive and well? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Mike Wagner, journalism professor at UW-Madison and faculty director of the Center for Communication and Civic Renewal, which recently released the results of their new Civic Fracture and Renewal Survey. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234. Where do you think we could find common ground when we disagree on politics? Us as people, political leaders and elected officials, whose responsibility is it to heal our political divides? Call in at 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Scott is with us in Iron River. Hi, Scott.
Yes. Hi, Rob and Mike. Nice to be on today. I'll start by saying just this morning I was replying to a friend on Facebook who posted something about, you know, making sure to get out and vote tomorrow. Then he also went on to speak of his dismay for, you know, the political state, the division that is going on. And interestingly enough, as I was replying on the radio, Comfortably Numb, Pink Floyd, Comfortably Numb was on, which, aside from being one of my top five favorite rock and roll songs, that's basically what I find myself. I've become comfortably numb to all the division. And at the same time, I have a strong yearning to want to do something about it. And I'm not a good debater. I don't argue well. So when I do talk politics, and I do have a number of friends who are strong, diehard Republicans, and they're very passionate about their views, and we've come to kind of the point to agree to not talk about politics. But if we do, or if I do with anybody, it's trying to find things that we can agree on.
I gotcha. I like Scott, you've already given us a ton to work with, and I want to give Mike some time to tackle that. First of all, that technique of, Scott says he's not a great debater. Well, maybe we don't need a lot of great debaters in our political conversations.
Yeah, you know, politics doesn't, at the community level, mm-hmm. doesn't always need to be about debate or right versus left or Republicans versus Democrats. Like amongst our elected officials, like, you know, most elected officials run for office under one of those two party labels. And so it's not surprising that they organize themselves to govern that way. But a lot of problems that we need to solve transcend party politics and happen at a more local level and don't necessarily require debate as much as people saying, here are problems I'm noticing, things I'm experiencing. Here are challenges I'm seeing. What ideas do we have to try to solve these problems? And our survey reveals just more and more of us think that we're not as good at solving these problems. 66% of Wisconsinites say that democracy in the United States is weaker than it used to be. One in five folks who are of lower income say that they find it really difficult to navigate the barriers to vote, and like, which is kind of the bare bones minimum of what we ought to be able to do in a democracy, and it's, we don't have equal access to that franchise. And so there's these different kinds of things happening that make it harder for us to feel like we can participate. Lots of people are uncomfortable talking politics or engaging in debate, you know, worrying about whether they have their facts right or you know, not thinking of the comeback until they're driving home, you know, and those sorts of things. And you know, not all political conversation needs to be blood sport, you know, even though our lawmakers often engage in contentious political behavior.
And briefly to Scott's point, his thought of being numb to politics, I hear from callers like disillusionment or frustration leading to wanting to get away from it. Is that something you're encountering in your work on these projects?
It is. And so this is the first in a series of reports we're going to release. And so I'll spoiler alert what's coming in April is that there's, since 2018, a growing sense of what we call news fatigue in Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. People just saying there's too many things happening, there's too much of a deluge, it is making me feel anxious and tired and overwhelmed, and it's too hard to keep up. And sometimes folks who feel especially fatigued conclude, I'm gonna actively pay less attention to what's going on. And the consequence then is that if people think, well, if I don't have to pay attention to what's going on, I'm sure I'll hear about the stuff that's really important. People who have that news will find me perspective are also folks who are more likely to endorse conspiracy theories. And so the fatigue is real, but our behavior in response to the fatigue can have negative consequences downstream.
Thanks a lot for that call. Jim joins us now in Green Bay. Jim, hello. Are you there, Jim? I think we lost Jim. Jim was saying that the public might like compromise, as you mentioned in the survey, Mike, but if elected officials don't seem to, Jim says they serve their own interests. And so the disjoint between what the public might want and differing motivations for elected officials.
Yeah, I mean, there's the public, like there are Wisconsinites, but then there are Wisconsinites who vote in partisan primaries, and those are different, right? And so if a lawmaker is going to compromise with folks in the other political party, and it's something that their most ardent and most participatory supporters don't like, there could be a consequence for them in their next election. And so even though most of us say most of the time we prefer compromise, it can come at a consequence for lawmakers. And the other issue, I'll say, just a limit of our ability to conduct surveys about compromise is that, you know, we all love compromise in the abstract. Now, what if I ask you to compromise on something you really care about? Maybe you're less interested in compromise on that thing.
Let's talk a little bit about participation. That's another thing you try to get into in the survey. What kind of things did you learn about our willingness to actually be involved?
Well, Wisconsinites are an involved people. Lots of folks engage in different kinds of political participation in Wisconsin. But there are some interesting differences in how we engage in that participation. And one of which is that about a quarter of us will say, even in our state, which is very participatory, that they avoid participating in politics because there are too many dangerous people out there. So people are saying, I'm aware that sometimes engaging in a public protest or some other kind of public-facing political event is something that could actually put my safety at risk. And so that kind of belief keeps about a quarter of us, according to the survey, in our state from participating. Those numbers are notably higher for Black Wisconsinites and Jewish and Muslim Wisconsinites. So groups that aren't in a numerical majority in the state especially feel that kind of danger.
And Mike, as we wrap up, you spoiled it a little bit. What is the timeline on the next bit of findings from your survey research?
So we interviewed about 3,000 Wisconsinites before the 2022 midterm elections, and we are interviewing as many of those as we can right now, actually, in the field. And so we're going to wrap up these interviews in the next couple of days so that we'll have talked to the same people twice and see how things change over time, and do a report dealing more with our media use and our social media use and online media use and how those things are associated with our attitudes and behaviors.
Sounds like a good reason to bring you back in a while.
We'd love it.
Mike, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That's Mike Wagner, journalism professor, faculty director of the Center for Communication and Civic Renewal at UW-Madison. He was with us today to share his organization's new Civic Fracture and Renewal Survey results. You can keep sharing your thoughts on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, some local governments are changing their budget process by getting the public more involved. Find out how participatory budgeting works and the impact it can have on community involvement and local decisions. That's tomorrow morning here on the Ideas Network. Do you like to swim? Do you ever swim underwater? I'll go a couple feet under the surface myself. Anything past that, my ears hurt a little. And I've never done scuba diving, probably never will. But here's something that swims a little deeper than I do, to the tune of 27,000 feet underwater. As reported by CNN, a deep sea project led by Japanese and Australian scientists has captured video of the deepest swimming fish ever caught on tape. It's a kind of snail fish. From the pictures, you might look and say, that's a fish? They're pinkish, translucent, kind of slimy looking. To this untrained observer, anyway. They live at the bottom of an ocean trench, and by swimming so low, they avoid a lot of those ocean predators. How do you get a picture of a fish 27,000 feet below the sea with a $200,000 underwater robot built precisely for the job? Well, I'm only going to see things maybe right there on the shore, and I'm not going to invest in that kind of machinery. But hey, I'm looking forward to finding more results. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.